Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Let me first thank the organizers and especially Attach for inviting me here and giving me the opportunity to present our most recent work in Vienna, although I myself moved to Stanford quite recently for about 2 years. But it's still a pleasure to talk about the results in the group of Anton Zeilinger. And you see that I have changed my title slightly from qubits only to also qnits. And this will actually be the second part of my talk. I will introduce you to a way in which we can use photons to give us a higher number of orthogonal ground states, which is not something particularly new. You could use photons in other ways and use many states of them. But we think it's a very useful way because it gives us very handy tools. The first part, of course, would be about our quantum communications experiment. And I will only talk about the photonic experiments. I will not talk about experiments that go on in our group with molecules and matter wave interferometry of those molecules. So I'll be talking about entanglement swapping, a generalization of teleportation, if you like that interpretation, or a tool for quantum networks, just as we have heard. And I will show you what we do in order to go to some to do some real teleportation, not tele on the optical table, but tele between buildings and on the large scale. And third, in the quantum communication section, I will show you how far we got with implementing entanglement purification procedures of general mixed states. Now, entanglement swapping has been introduced a while ago. Actually, initially, I think it was for the idea of doing event-ready Bell-type experiments. When you have when you do a Bell experiment, the original idea was that whenever a pair is emitted, you know that the pair is emitted, and therefore you can make your detectors ready for that detection event. Now, entanglement swapping has been generalized, and this was basically work of Peter Knight and Sugata Bose, to a procedure where you have, say, a couple of entangled systems, and you subject them to a Bell state measurement, and that Bell state measurement converts the entanglement or redistributes the entanglement in your system to say if you had two pairs, 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 entangled, then after the Bell state measurement you would find pairs 2 and 3 and 1 and 4 entangled. Or here in the lower case you could take two GHZ states, one GHZ state and two pairs, and by a GHC measurement, if that is the equivalent of a Bell state measurement, you will create a 4-particle GHC and a 3-particle GHC. Now, this is probably a bit far in the future, but I will show you how well we get on with this upper case here. And as I mentioned already, entanglement swapping has been, used by Hans Briegel and Peter Zoller in the idea of quantum repeaters that help us to overcome the usual exponential decay of entanglement quality with the channel length. I would say it might even be useful in other things where we don't go to long distances. Now, the way we work is that we only use in the quantum communication business, we use only the polarization of photons. So we have a qubit where the two polarization states are our basis states, the computational basis. And those basis states we usually call H and V, horizontal and vertical, but you might as well call them 0 and 1 if you prefer. And in entanglement swapping, we start with two sources of entangled pairs. So we have two independent pairs in the first place. If they are not created in a coherent way, we write them as a tensor product. And if you take that state and multiply it out, you find that you can as well decompose that joint state of the two particles as a sum of products of Bell state, but now be aware of the fact that here the Bell states have different indices. I have Bell states of particle 1 and 4 and 2 and 3. So when I subject particles 2 and 3 to a Bell state measurement, I will find it in one of the four Bell states, and just accordingly at the same time particles 1 and 4 will also be in the same Bell state. Now how can we do that Bell state measurement? We do it in a so-called Bell state analyzer, which I will explain in a second. But first let me give you a different view on entanglement swapping. Here I said we can project particles 2 and 3 onto one of the states, but we knew, the point is we do not know what the outcome will be. If the particles were independent in the first place, each of the four Bell states is equally likely. So we don't have a way to force the two particles to a certain Bell state. And now another way of looking at that is that you have a third party named Victor, and he looks at the result of that Bell state analyzer. And this is a way in which he can, in some sense, non-locally or from a different place, select the data that Bob measures on particles, one should be 1 and 4 on the far left and right, and select the data there. And now if he selects, for example, the data that belongs to a psi minus observation at the Bell state analyzer, he will be able to violate Bell's inequality with that selected data. Now, there's no way that you do that with classical. I mean, you can't just produce numbers in two places and then select the data and violate the Bell inequality, except, of course, if you look at the data in the first place and select it according to the data. But the selection is done here, of course, conditioned on the detection on the other two sides, conditioned on the result of the Bell state measurement. And it turns out that you can show the effect even if you're not able to see all the Bell states, right? Because that selection would work for every of those subsets. Now, the Bell state analysis itself, in our case, works as in Jeff Kimball's case on a beam splitter, but unfortunately, it will not work perfectly. We use the fact that if you put two photons on that beam splitter from two individual sides, and you know that there is one photon in each mode, then there are two possibilities that you get a coincidence detection after that beam splitter. And this is well known as a Hong-U-Mandel interferometer, discovered by those gentlemen in 1989. And we could think of this as a second-order interference. Now, the coincidence detection will finally project the input state onto a psi minus state. This is in retrodiction. If you detect the coincidence after the beam splitter, you can say, before the beam splitter, I had a psi minus state. And it turns out that only this state will produce a coincidence. One thing that we have to be sure of is that the particles that we put in here are made coherent in second order. So we have to erase any information that might make them distinguishable. And we have been playing a bit in the last years to improve the Bell state measurement, because it turns out that it was not very good in the beginning. And the final way in which we did this was to use a single mode fiber beam splitter, because on that single mode fiber beam splitter we'll have a perfect mode overlap. So there is one way to distinguish the photons is erased. There's no way to distinguish them by their spatial wave function. And the only thing that remains to be erased is the timing information, and the timing information is compensated by moving that fiber coupler. Now there's a few more things that you have to think about, and this is polarization, because you know that in a single mode fiber the polarization will change as it propagates, so you have to make sure that polarization matches on the beam splitter, and it ordinarily you only align one, align the orthogonal system and don't care about the phase between H and V, say. But in that case, of course, you have to align it in you have to align the whole space. And you see the results of that. What we observe is we scan that delay and we look for, in that these are fourfold coincidences between the outer and the inner detectors. You can also see an effect if you only observe the inner two, but it's not as pronounced. And if we observe that, we see that the coincidence rate drops to zero for certain settings of the polarizers. Now, if we look at this as in a fidelity picture, where fidelity means here conditioned on the detection of a photon or of four photons, we managed with that fiber Belstedt analyzer to go beyond the limit that is set by the violation of a Bell inequality. In order to violate the Bell inequality, you need an interference contrast or a polarization correlation of more than 71%, which translates to a fidelity of 85%. And you also see that it degrades a bit in the 45 degree basis as compared to the horizontal and vertical basis, which is simply due to the fact that our conversion crystals that produce the photons will produce them initially in H and V, and we have to make them coherent by a compensation procedure. Now, the same picture, just in a different view, is if we look at the correlation coefficient of polarization measurements. This is polarization measurements on particles 1 and 4, the outer two particles, and we compare the parallel to the orthogonal polarizations. And this is the expression that we want to insert into a Bell inequality observation. Now, as we put this into a CHSH inequality, where of course we have to assume that we have a fair sampling, otherwise we could not with that setup violate a local realistic theory. If we put that in, we find that Bell's inequality is strongly violated by about four standard deviations, where the statistics here is somewhat limited by the observation time. I mean, we produce our particle pairs randomly, so there's no deterministic pair source yet, and of course it takes some time until you get a sufficient number of two pair events in those two crystals. Going further with that type of entanglement swapping might need some improvement in the Belstedt analysis. Now, there was a proof. Actually, it appeared only recently, but I think it was done already a couple of years ago. No, not a couple, maybe one or two. That said that a perfect Belstedt analyzer for linear optics in the case of photonic qubits, not in the case of continuous variables, of course, is not possible. And it also said in a second paper that the maximum efficiency would be 50% if you had no errors. But it turned out that the important assumption that limits the efficiency is that there are no ancillary photons. And we heard just yesterday in a very nice introduction that if you allow for auxiliary photons and some also some feed forward, although I think that's not really necessary, you can really go to 100%. But now experimentally, I would say for the next few years we'll still have to stick with the first part. But there is one thing. In the previous scheme that I showed you, the efficiency was only 25%. We were only able to detect the psi minus Belstedt. And now, to improve a bit here, we would like to go to a scheme where we can see 50% efficiency, and this is just by inserting polarizers after the psi minus Belstedt analyzer. And then, conditioned on various patterns in the detection of the four photons in the Belstedt analyzer, you can distinguish, for example, the psi minus and the psi plus state. You will see some signature, but you cannot distinguish phi plus or phi minus. And in order to improve our teleportation scheme, we want to use that to really perform a unitary operation, which was basically left out in the previous reduced teleportation schemes. Now, why do we do all that? This is because we finally want to go to a long distance teleportation scheme, which is already in preparation to take the teleportation out of the laboratory for the first time and do it actually from the Vienna side of the Danube River to the Danube Island. And maybe in a later scheme, we could extend with the same setup, basically to a kind of entanglement swapping procedure, if we take or if we make use of that other part, which is actually a sewage facility. So this is a large duct that is underground. It goes under the river, and there are very big tubes down there, about I think 1.5 meters in diameter, where they pump the sewage water from the eastern part of Vienna to the western part to put it into a recycling facility. But you see that the duct itself is very nice. There is no smell and no humidity. So yeah, we were already teased by our colleagues that now we are the channel rats or something. But it will be a very nice environment, and there is it's very easy to put in some fiber optic cable there. And the distance will approximately be 700 meters. And the nice thing is that we can take that classical information and send it via a microwave link, which we have already tested, because there is an unblocked line of sight from one to the other station. And we get very nice support for this from the company that runs the sewage facility. I should mention that. Now, this is a very good point to change to a different topic of quantum communication, which is entanglement purification. And entanglement purification was mentioned as a way to improve channel length if you have a channel that degrades the entanglement as it propagates. Well, personally, I must say that in a long distance experiment that we did previously, we didn't see much degrading of the entanglement, as did our colleagues in Geneva. But essentially, whenever you have a channel that does some degradation, it will always be exponential. So I'm sure there is an application for purification sometimes. And in purification, we can use a number of, say, less entangled pairs and subject them to a procedure that will distill out of those lesser entangled pairs a few better entangled pairs. Now, the original scheme that was suggested by Charlie Bennett and others suggested to use two control NOT gates and basically to detect the joint state of the two pairs. And of course, you've gained some information in that case, so you always lose one pair, but you will distill out another pair that has better entanglement finally. In this case here, you would select the pair up there whenever the measurements in the computational basis down here on the target pair agree, if both are zero or both are one. Now, as we don't have a control NOT gate, my friends Chen-Wei Pan, Christoph Simon, and Czaslaw Bruckner invented a scheme where they replaced the control NOT gate by polarizing beam splitters. Now, there's of course some drawback in that, and the drawback is the efficiency. The efficiency drops by a factor of two. But still, the procedure works very similar. You have a source pair and a target pair, although I think they're now much more symmetric, so you don't need to call them source and target. And in the outputs of the polarizing beam splitter, you do a measurement in the 45 degree basis, or plus and minus basis. And the important purification doesn't really happen on that measurement, but it happens on the selection of the outputs of the beam splitter. The point is, you only take those cases where you have one photon in every output, A3, A4, B3, and B4. the point being that we cannot use the case where there are two photons in one mode, because we right now we don't have, I mean they exist, but we don't have any detectors that can detect or that can distinguish between one and two photons. The way in which this works is that you assume that you have a state that is with some high fidelity, one of the Bell states, and with some lower fraction, one of the other Bell states. Now it turns out that this is this seems to be a bit restrictive to assume that there is only some kind of noise associated with that Bell state, but it, as in the original proposal by Charlie Bennett, it turns out that it can do some bilateral rotation to change that admixture of psi plus here into a homogeneous admixture of the other Bell states. And it turns out that the purification works just as well. Now, if we take two pairs, the correct state, or the state that we want, will appear with a frequency f squared, and the state that we don't want at all will appear with a very low fraction 1 minus f squared. Now, the selection of the cases where both outputs of the polarizing beam splitter receive a photon already erases the cross terms. And that means that we are already nearly done with our purification procedure, because those are gone, and remaining is only the case where we have the good state with a high, even higher fraction, and the very bad state with a very low fraction. Oh. Okay. There is one more thing, and that is that Alice and Bob, of course, have to measure one pair to determine that there was one photon. And for present detectors, of course, they will also have to detect the other output modes. So if you have a scheme where you don't want to use detection, this will not work for you. And now they detect the plus and minuses here, and depending on the result, they get a sign in the final state of the source pair, and that sign basically is a phase flip, and if they apply that phase flip, they get back the original phi plus state. Experimentally, things are not yet done, but I would say the experiment is already set up and working, and actually there is one thing, and that is we can use spatial entanglement from our source to enhance the output of that purification machine. That's a very good thing. The point is that if we do it very carefully, we can have the emission of one pair in the forward direction and one pair in the backward direction in a coherent way. And if we maintain that, if we maintain that coherence, we can use the interferometer that we built here to make sure that we have nearly only those four-mode cases. So we can design the interference such that those cases don't appear. And that increases the efficiency of our purification scheme. This is actually in a paper which is now on QuantFIS, also by Jen Wei and Christoph. And as I said, my colleagues Sarah and Jen Wei have already set this up on a very small platform, and the integration of that whole thing made the count rates also much better. But that reminds me of, this is probably, I would say, the most complex interferometer that we can nowadays build on the optical table for that kind of photon source. I mean, if you have laser sources, everything's easier. I would say to make even more complicated interferometers would definitely require some waveguide technology. I'm thinking of the interferometers that Manik Nil is suggesting for linear optics quantum computation. This is a good point to introduce the group. Actually, some people are missing on that picture, but this is Jen Wei Pan and Zara working on the purification experiments. And this is Thomas Jennewein on quantum communication stuff, Guido Chaya, master student, and Ali Pasha Vasiri. He's the guy who is working on the QNITs. And this is now the second part of my talk, in which I will introduce orbital angular momentum states. There are some other people I want to mention, especially Alois Meyer, who is now at Harvard Smithsonian. He was basically the inventor of the orbital angular momentum states of photon. Not the inventor, but the one who thought this would be an interesting tool for quantum communications. Now, as I said, we want to use, or we want to have a system with which we can observe photon states with a higher basis than just two. I mean, why would we want to do this? This is maybe one thing that I find very nice. I don't have it here. Is the Byzantine agreement problem? You probably have heard about that, and I don't know if it's still true, but it seems to turn out that you can only do this with a three, with a qutrit, and not with a qubit. The thing that we want to use, the basis that we want to use, is orbital or external angular momentum states of light. Now, this is a very fancy name. You could also say we're just working in a Laguerre-Gaussian or donut mode basis of linear optical momentum, because there's no reason that we should use some preferred decomposition of the momentum states. But it turns out that those modes are stable in their shape when they propagate, and we can convert them between each other. And if we do an interferometer that involves more states, this will only be affected by some changes in the transverse pattern. It will not be affected by length fluctuations of our whole apparatus. And this is one of the big advantages here. Now, some of the things we did already, we showed that the orbital angular momentum is conserved in parametric down conversion. I will show you that briefly. And we wanted to study that angular momentum. It's not actually a true angular momentum, it turns out. It's a quasi-angular momentum. But I think it's an interesting thing. And one thing is that we want to do a three-state Bell inequality test, and very recently we succeeded in doing so. It's not the first test of this kind. The first is probably done by Dick Baumeister, and I'm sure he'll talk about it. Now, some very simple characteristics. All the modes that we use look like this, like a ring. We only use the LG0L. We don't use the higher radial indices for the reason of, well, we were concerned originally with the orbital angular momentum, and if you change the radial mode index, that doesn't change. I might also remind you of the Hermite Gaussian modes because we will use them. And one way in which we can use them is that we can force the laser to oscillate in the Hermite Gaussian mode, and then we take two cylindrical lenses, and if the angle here is 45 degrees between the axis and that Hermite Gaussian mode, those cylindrical lenses and the focus that the Hermite Gaussian mode goes through will introduce a phase, and that phase is just a pi over 2, and finally, sending this in, we'll get out a Laguerre-Gaussian mode. And we force the laser to oscillate in a certain mode by putting in a wire. There's various other techniques for that. But a much better tool to convert the various Laguerre-Gaussian modes is holograms with dislocations. Now, this is a simple line grating, except for the fact that it has one line that ends in the middle. Now, if you send a Gaussian beam through that, then you, in the first diffraction order, you will observe a Laguerre-Gaussian mode of first order. In the minus first order, you will observe one of minus first order. So you have plus one angular momentum quantum or minus one angular momentum quantum. And with appropriate blazing, we can arrange it such that nearly 100% will go into the first order. So we have a nearly perfect mode transformer. Images, these are electron microscopy images of holograms that were done in Jena at the Institute of Angewandte Physik. And this is a picture of the light coming out of a self-made hologram. Right? With this hologram, you only see one beam, so it's not that impressive, although it's much better. And then the way in which we actually finally project the state is that we use a single-mode optical fiber, which you can see here. And the single-mode fiber will only couple the Gaussian mode, the LG00. It will not couple the LG01 or any other higher term, simply because they have a bigger mode pattern. And now, if we combine this with one of our here self-made holograms, we can project onto any mode. But there is one drawback: we don't have something like a polarizing beam splitter. We don't have a device that will that has, say, 100% efficient outputs for all of the modes. And this will be a bit of a drawback. Finally, we thought actually about having someone design a waveguide that would support two or three modes, and then design a kind of mode splitter. And we were told that this would be possible, but I think the development costs are right now too high. No one wants to do that. Now, the point is we wanted to observe the conservation of orbital angular momentum in parametric down conversion. And we did this by sending a pump beam through, a pump beam of various orbital angular momentum states, and observing various orbital angular momentum states in coincidence behind the down conversion crystal. And it turns out the orbital angular momentum is very nicely conserved. When we send in a pump beam with zero orbital angular momentum, the down conversion photons, when we measure them in their various states, will always add up to the pump orbital angular momentum. And I should say that here the rows are normalized, because in fact we would observe more 0-0 coincidences than 1-1 coincidences, right? And the reason for that is that the source size of our pump beam shining through the crystal is limited. So the probability to get an emission in a certain higher orbital angular momentum state is also limited. And then the question was, we have those components, but do we really have a coherent state, or do we have a mixture? Now, there is the reason that, or for the reason that people already observed that there is momentum, linear momentum entanglement from those sources, suggests that there should be entanglement also in the angular momentum, because there is no fundamental difference between the two. And then we undertook some preliminary measurements on superpositions, because if you have a certain number of states and now you want to see whether they are coherent, you go to a superposition basis, you observe in the superposition basis and look if you still have the correlation. And it turns out those superpositions are quite handy. If we look at superpositions of just the 0 and 1 mode, we see that they look like a offset donut. It's like a donut which was not done very nicely in the bakery. And depending on the amplitude ratio, the donut shifts more and more out, the donut hole. And depending on the phase angle, we see the donut hole appear at a certain azimuth angle. And then we asked ourselves, well, how can we observe in a superposition basis? Because up to now, I only showed you that we can observe in a certain, one of the 0, 1, and so on basis states. And it turns out if you take one of those holograms that I showed you and you displace it a bit from the beam center, it will actually produce a superposition. I mean, there is a natural explanation. If it's in the center and you go in with a Gaussian beam, you observe nearly 100% detection. Well, no, it's 80% of an LG 0-1 beam. And if you move the hologram far out, of course the dislocation is not in the beam anymore, and it will observe a Gaussian beam. And in between you can achieve any superposition ratio that you want, and you see that there is a slight part of LG02 which is necessary, otherwise the thing would not be unitary. And so a first observation was to check if we shift one hologram and monitor the other side, whether we would see the appropriate superposition. And these are some traces simply taken with a chart recorder by Alois Meyer in Innsbruck. And they suggest that there is some coherence, because it seems that the trace always has a zero somewhere, whereas for a mixture, it wouldn't have a zero. A mixture of a Gaussian and an LG beam always has a finite intensity. But that was not yet convincing enough. So very recently we did two holograms, one hologram on both sides, and shifted them around. And it turns out that the picture that we get suggests very much that we have something like the pure state. The mixture always looks like that. The pure state, it depends a bit on the phases that we set. I think that this picture was quite convincing. So we finally decided to go for the ultimate test, and this is a Bell inequality test. And of course, we didn't want to do a two-state Bell inequality test, but a three-state Bell inequality test. And it turned out that only recently some good three-state inequalities were discovered by Kasielowski and others, and by Collins and others, nearly simultaneously, I would say. And finally, we decided to use the one discovered by Collins, because you see, in the one up here, this is an equivalent of a CH inequality, Clauser-Horn inequality. Clauser-Horn inequality involves singles count rates, and it's clear that with our present setup, there's no way that we can violate a strong Bell inequality, one which involves singles count rates. The one down here is more like CH-SH inequality, and it has only coincidence count rates. Here you see some kind of, I would say, generalized correlation function for each measurement. So what you need is you need four measurements, two settings on both sides. We call them settings 1 and 2. And if you do it ideally for the ideal quantum Q-trit state, you get a very strong violation of the inequality. You see this expression should be smaller than 2, and the quantum value could go up as high as 2.87. But now, then we were concerned that with our state that we get out of the source, this might not be the ideal symmetric state. So would we have to look for the optimal measurement in order to violate the inequality? If we just take the measurements that are good for the ideal state, it would probably be below the limit. Now, I tried to do that calculation, but it turned out it was pretty difficult to calculate the optimal shift of the holograms. And of course, in the laboratory, it's also not so easy to find the exact center position and then the exact offset. So what we finally decided is to do what we call a brute force attack on the inequality. Here we have our setup. There is a down conversion crystal that produces the two potentially orbital angular momentum entangled beams. And we have a transforming stage where there are two holograms, one with a plus dislocation, one with a minus dislocation. And now, as we move those holograms, we can sample a certain fraction, I would say, of that minus 1, 0, plus 1 Hilbert space. And as we do this on both sides, we can observe a wide range of correlations. And then we have our projection device that projects just probabilistically onto the zero state, the minus one state, and the plus state. That is what I said. We don't have something like a polarizing beam splitter, so we have to use an ordinary beam splitter and then project onto the individual modes. So we did that. I think Ali took a scan for overnight, and then looked for violation of the Q-trit inequality. And it turns out, this is a picture of what we had in the lab, that the violation was better than expected. You see that we even have one value of, I think, 16,000 values that lies over the quantum limit, but not if you include the error bar. And this was a quite coarse-grained scan, so there's nothing to worry about here. This is something like a pseudo-distribution. I think I should stop now. But this is a pseudo-distribution of the values that violate the Bell inequality. We took this four-dimensional scan, and this makes a huge data array. And then we searched it, and this is the only figure that I could produce in the shortest of time, because these results are, I think, only a week old. You see that the high violations are not as likely. And this is probably the case because the state is not the optimally symmetric state. The state is, I would say, it's something like if the 0-0 component has a 1 amplitude, then the minus 1-1 and the 1 minus 1 states have amplitudes of 0.8. So we're not very far from the symmetric state, but also not ideally close. Well, that is the status, and I'm just about to sum up. We see that parametric down conversion conserves the orbital angular momentum, and that we can produce states like this one here, where the C's decrease as we go to higher orders, although we have found a way to engineer this a bit. And we think that this is a very useful tool because, as I showed you, the whole thing is very stable. There is nothing where a simple phase or temperature drift would mess up our observation basis. And therefore, we think that this is a very useful tool for exploring the higher dimensional Hilbert spaces. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We have time for one or two questions.
You mentioned earlier in the talk about using beam splitters for Bell state purification. And I see for Bell state measurement, but for purification, there's an issue of efficiency, how efficient that process can be. As I understand it, there's a problem with that. Can you talk about the efficiency?
Right. I think in the original proposal, the efficiency was just half that of the Bennett proposal. Half the efficiency, so you sacrifice twice as many pairs. Whereas in that case where we use spatial entanglement, things are different because it's not a pure purification, but it's also something that involves transformation or conversion of momentum entanglement to polarization entanglement. So it purifies, but also I would say, just moves the entanglement around in the Hilbert space. And therefore, the efficiency can be nearly as high as in the Bennett proposal, where we use control NOT gates.
Other questions?
Yes.
I think I think if we could devise a waveguide device, yeah, that just supports the modes that we want, say the 0 and plus and minus 1, although there's an issue because in most of the waveguides, once the higher order modes set on, you have a lot of them. But then you could think of the way that normally beam splitters are designed in fibers is just that you bring the cores close together, and then various modes have different coupling lengths. So if you would do that with that many mode waveguide, you could well think of a splitter that splits off the various amplitudes of those modes. But I'm not a waveguide expert, so I don't know if there's someone who can do that.
More questions? If not, let's thank Gregory again. And we reconvene at 11 a.m. in half an hour.